on Nightlife, let's talk about pre-diabetes. About 2 million of us are pre-diabetic. Now, the symptoms can be hard to spot, but it's a serious indicator that you're at risk of developing full-blown type 2 diabetes. There's a massive problem with diabetes in Australia, as we know. It's a huge burden on the health system and, of course, on those who suffer from it. As we know, there's been a big surge in type 2 diabetes cases in recent years. Doctors and other health experts say it's largely attributable to lifestyle and the fact that most of us are unfortunately growing our waistline. Nearly a million Australians have been diagnosed with the disease. Rather than being a foregone conclusion, though, knowing if you're pre-diabetic could be the message you need to start looking after your health. That's what we want to have a chat about tonight. Love you to join us in that conversation. Joining me tonight, Dr. Alan Barclay is an accredited practicing dietitian, also research associate at the University of Sydney, and author of the book Reversing Diabetes. And he joins us in the studio. Alan, good to have you with us and welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you very much for having me.
Nice to have you in. Also joining us, diabetes educator Carolyn Corniff is with us as well. Carolyn, good to have you in as well. Welcome to Nightlife.
Glad to be here.
Alan, should we start with you? What's pre-diabetes anyway?
So to use its more scientific terms, it's impaired glucose tolerance or impaired fasting glycemia. And basically that means that your blood glucose levels are higher than normal, but you don't have type 2 diabetes yet. So it's sort of a grey area between normal blood glucose levels and diabetes type 2.
Do you have any symptoms of this?
You might not. Type 2 diabetes itself is a fairly insidious disease. And That's right. It creeps up without you sort of knowing it. And you might feel a little bit tired, a bit run down. You might getting a few more infections than normal, but there might not be anything obvious because you don't have diabetes type 2 yet, and therefore you're not necessarily getting the excessive thirst and urination that's characteristic of that condition. So really, you might feel a little bit off, but you're not really getting the classic symptoms of diabetes.
Gee, that's tough, isn't it? Feeling a little bit off.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, people feel a little bit off for all sorts of reasons.
With age.
You know, exactly. When you get older and you don't do enough exercise, generally you can often feel a little bit off.
Yeah, and it's a bit like the boiling frog, you know, you're sort of slowly getting, feeling less and less well, but because it's happening gradually over time, you really can't tell. So that's why it is an insidious disease, and it's often picked up serendipitously by accident.
Yeah, okay. Is it sort of inevitable if you, or what causes it, do we know, Carolyn? Is it inevitable if you don't look after yourself to some degree?
I think if you follow a healthy lifestyle and our exercise diet, you can minimise the risk. But if we get old enough, eventually I think we're all going to get diabetes. Similarly, if you live long enough, we all end up with cancer one day. Mm. I think that's kind of a given, but there is a lot we can do to try and minimise the risk and delay the onset.
Yeah. What are the actual symptoms of pre-diabetes? Alan?
Well, there aren't necessarily symptoms of pre-diabetes. As I said, it's type 2 diabetes where you get the classic symptoms, which are excessive thirst and urination. You might get blurred vision.
Does that come on quickly or suddenly?
It's often slow. I mean, it depends on the person. There can be life events, you know, excessive stress, or you've had an accident, or you've had some sort of illness that will bring it on quickly. But otherwise, it's a consequence of aging, as Carolyn said. In those, of course, that are genetically predisposed, so whether they've got a family history or some other predisposing factor. So, you know, it's one of those reasons why we do tell people who are over a certain age to get tested regularly by their GP. And there's a very simple test. So I mentioned there's impaired fasting glucose and impaired glucose tolerance, and there are two different types of tests that you can have with that your GP can organise. And I guess if you've got somebody with a family history, so mum, dad, brothers, sisters, uncle, aunts, grandparents, what have you, have had type 2 diabetes, then it's a good idea to get tested when you're mid-40s.
I don't think I've ever been tested for it. I mean, that's probably because there's none in my family.
Mm.
Is it a regular test, Carolyn,
by doctor? It's a very easy test to do for your doctor.
Is
yes,
it? What is it, a blood test, is it?
Yep, just a regular blood test, similar how they check cholesterol levels or a kidney function test. The doctor takes a bit of blood, it goes off to the laboratory, and they can check how much glucose is in the blood at that given time.
Mm.
That's the blood glucose level. There's also another test called the HbA1c, which is sort of more of an average of or a long-term way of measuring glucose in the blood.
Hmm. All right, so this test wouldn't be routinely done, would it? Would it only be done if you ask for it?
It is more and more routinely done.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got a good GP, then they should put that into the normal package of your annual screening because, as you said, diabetes is so common, so it is good for everybody to get tested, particularly once you get over the age of 50. I think it's good to get it checked at least once a year, make sure that we're on the right track still.
Mm. Alan, is it if you test and you are pre-diabetic as opposed to being diabetic, what just explain to us, I want to get clear the difference here.
So pre-diabetes, your blood glucose levels are higher than normal,
right?
But you don't have diabetes, and it's determined by the blood glucose test that Carolyn mentioned. So if your blood glucose is between 6.1 and 7, then you have pre-diabetes. If it's over 7, then you have type 2 diabetes. So, and although it doesn't sound serious because you don't have type 2 diabetes yet, we know when blood glucose levels go over about 5.5, the risk of heart disease and stroke start to go up. So it's really an alarm bell that you're heading in the type 2 diabetes direction. You haven't got there yet, but it doesn't mean you should sit on your laurels and wait for it to happen. You should really start making some changes to your lifestyle so that you don't start getting type 2 diabetes.
But you wouldn't necessarily feel any different, would you?
Again, it's insidious. It is really a feeling, a sort of rundown, vague symptoms that a lot of us would just simply attribute to aging.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think I'd like to add that even with type 2 diabetes, most people don't even have the symptoms, because the symptoms of the thirst, the frequent urination, all those things don't actually happen until your sugar level go over 15. And a lot of people have that slightly elevated of sort of in diabetes of 7 or to 10. And that can be enough to develop complications. As Alan said, even just sugars over 5, 6 can start to change the vasculature in the body. So you can start having a higher risk of heart disease and strokes and things like that.
Okay. If you've got pre-diabetes because your blood glucose is high, does that mean as night follows day, you're going to become a diabetic?
No, not at all. So it's about 1 in 3 people that go on to develop type 2 diabetes.
Quite high, though, in that sense.
It's relatively
about 30%.
High.
Yeah.
But, you know, on the other hand, it's good odds that you can prevent it from happening too. So it's 2 out of 3, of course, can prevent it.
How long will it take to go from pre-diabetes to a full type 2 diabetic condition?
Everybody is different, and it would depend on a number of factors: your starting age, your genetic predisposition, what your weight is like and whether you're gaining weight and whether there's been other stresses in your life. So it's multifactorial and we can't predict the exact time, but you're probably talking about, you know, years. It's not months. It's a slow burn.
Okay. Is there a particular stage in life, Carolyn, that we're going to experience this?
I guess pre-diabetes can happen at any stage in life, but the majority of people that will be diagnosed with pre-diabetes will be sort of 45, 50 onwards.
Mm-hmm.
The older we get, the higher the risk.
Okay. All right. Can we do anything about it? I suppose this is the $64.
We certainly can.
This is the $64 question. Well, can we? I mean, well, two questions, I guess, and that's the focus of tonight's conversation too. Can we do anything about it? In other words, can we stop it, or can we reverse it, or can we do both?
Yeah, you can certainly do both. So obviously you can stop it from developing in the first place, but if you do get it, then you can put it back into remission, shall we say.
Right. What that is, it stop getting it worse. Does it make it stop getting worse?
Or you can go back to normal blood glucose levels.
Okay.
So that's the remission side of things. But as Caroline said, it is a function of aging. If we live long enough, you know, once you get over the mid-70s, it's about 1 in 4 people that have it. So the longer we live, and Australians, of course, are living longer every year, our average lifespan goes up. So it is a function of aging. So you can delay it, but eventually you might end up getting it if you have that strong disposition.
Hmm. Okay, all right. Does everyone who develops type 2 diabetes necessarily go through a period when they're pre-diabetic?
Yes, I would say so. But for a lot of them, that's a period that remains undiagnosed. So usually diabetes develops quite gradually over years. Type 2 diabetes, that is. Type 1 is a completely different picture. That develops over just a matter of a couple of weeks. But type 2, because it develops over years, that there is that grey zone where people are in for a while, often undiagnosed.
I know we've discussed this before, but for those who are just tuning in or listening, maybe you should distinguish between type 1 and type 2 diabetes for us, just so that people understand what we're talking about here. Carolyn?
Yeah. So type 1 diabetes is more an autoimmune disease. Not a great deal we can do about that, and we don't know exactly the origins. So viral infections often play a role in that.
Mm-hmm.
And people with type 1 diabetes always need insulin injections because their pancreas doesn't produce insulin anymore, at least not enough for the body to function. Whereas in type 2 diabetes, often there is an increase in insulin production because there is something we refer to as insulin resistance. The cells of the body don't respond well to the insulin, and therefore the insulin can't unlock the cell quick or efficiently enough. And that helps the glucose levels in the blood to rise. So it's a different issue. People with type 2 diabetes mostly, firstly, get told to follow a diet and exercise to try and minimize glucose coming into the system or burning it up more if we can, but also then needing treatments. So they usually start with one or two different type of tablets, we call them oral agents, and eventually they might progress to needing insulin as well. But that's a completely different picture.
Yeah, we hear a bit about insulin resistance. What are the clues that you might have it?
One of the clues can be if you've got a black line in your neck. If you're really overweight, you might get blackening off the back of the neck.
Really?
And in under your armpits. That can be an indication of insulin resistance. For women, if they're having difficulty falling pregnant and they've been diagnosed with polycystic ovarian syndrome, that's often an indicator that they're at risk of insulin resistance as well. And central obesity is another big giveaway.
Okay, we're talking about pre-diabetes and pre-diabetic conditions tonight. Sue from Geelong's texted saying, why did they intervene aggressively with pre-diabetes? I've just moved to type 2, but would in retrospect, had I had interventions, it might have been prevented. Alan?
Yeah, I agree. I think we don't take pre-diabetes seriously enough. And if we did, we would intervene. We would get people to lose 10 to 15% of their starting body weight is usually enough to put people into remission, which is not a huge amount. So if you're 80 kilos, you lose 8 to 12 kilos.
That's probably a bit of an ask for people, though, isn't it?
10% is achievable for most people, so it's not that
wouldn't
difficult.
Be achievable without a fairly aggressive change of lifestyle.
So you need to eat about 2,000 kilojoules less per day, and you need to be doing about an hour of physical exercise a day. So yes, it requires a commitment, but it's not. We're not talking biggest loser stuff here, you know. So it is achievable. That sort of weight loss is achievable for most people, and we're talking about 0.5 to 1 kilo weight loss per week. It's not a huge. It doesn't have to happen overnight. It should be achievable for most people. And I think we really do need to take it more seriously. I think prevention is better than cure, obviously.
Okay. Joe says, 12 months ago, I had pre-diabetes with the support of an outstanding GP. I'm now 26 kilograms lighter and with normal blood tests. It's been brutal, but it's been worth the effort, I suppose, underlying what you're saying.
Absolutely.
Alan.
Yes.
Sorry, Caroline.
I was just going to say, well done, Joe.
Yeah.
That's right.
Sally says, I reversed my type 2 in 6 months on a low-carb, healthy fat diet after 2 years on metformin. I don't know what that is, but you will, I'm sure. I don't take anything now, and I haven't for over a year. HbA1c is now 5.7. I'm also off cholesterol tablets as well. Hats off to you too, I guess, are we saying?
Absolutely.
Mm. All right, let's grab a call or two. Jenny from St Leonard's. Jen, hi.
Good evening. How are you guys happening? It's really great to hear some sensible explanations of pre-diabetes and type 2 diabetes. I have lived with type 1 for 56, 57 years,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of people spread the wrong information about all the diabetes, and it's so difficult to... there's no bucket of money available for a huge national education program for everybody. So I'm wondering what your guests can say about trying to teach the community at large.
Hmm. Carolyn, do you want to have a go at this?
Yeah, so one of my roles, my many hats, is I work for Diabetes New South Wales and ACT, and through the NDSS program, the National Diabetic Services Scheme, we provide programs, educational programs for people living with diabetes, their carers, and also going out to healthcare professionals and, yeah, trying to spread the word on diabetes. And Diabetes New South Wales has been around for 80 years. We've just celebrated our 80th birthday. I certainly hear your concern, Jen, that there is a lot of misconceptions about diabetes. A lot of people think that if you've got diabetes that it's kind of self-inflicted, and type 1 is certainly not one of those.
No.
There is no escape possible with type 1. If you're getting it, you're getting it, and because it's autoimmune, it's not something you've done to yourself. And even type 2 diabetes, often people think that that's self-inflicted because there is that big association to obesity. But not all people with diabetes or pre-diabetes are overweight.
That's important to add, isn't it? Although there's a correlation, isn't there, Alan?
Oh, there is a correlation, but it's particularly where you carry it. So you can be within the healthy weight range, but if you carry the weight around your middle, continental... Indians and indigenous populations around the world, Australian Aboriginals, they're often quite thin, but they'll carry extra weight around the middle. Mm-hmm. So it really is where you carry the weight that's important and not the total weight as such. That's why, yes, people that are not technically overweight can certainly get type 2 diabetes. Mm.
Okay, if we're going to make changes to our diet and lifestyle, is it our old friend's diet and exercise, I suppose, is it?
Well,
what sort of diet and exercise are we talking about?
I'll talk about diet. look, really, it's about eating less.
Is it?
And around about 2,000 kilojoules per day less. There are many different ways of eating.
Give us an example of what 2,000 kilojoules looks like.
Well, I guess the best way to put it into context, so we're supposed to be eating around about 8,700 kilojoules a day for an average adult, so it's about a quarter of that.
So eating a quarter of what you're eating.
Eating a quarter less.
Less.
Or to flip it around, so three quarters of what the average person eats now is probably enough. We're eating 25% more than what we ought to eat. So, and a simple way to cut that out for a lot of people is actually cutting out snacks. Just sticking to breakfast, lunch and dinner and cutting out in between meal snacks is a good way of cutting that down. We know from our most recent National Nutrition Survey, we get about a third of our calories, shall we say, from what we call discretionary food. So if we cut out all of those treats that we seem to have daily, which we should be saving for special occasions, parties and the like, then that would certainly be one easy way for people to cut down on their kilojoules.
Pete from Dorigo says, I came down with type 2 and had cellulitis in my legs. I lost 85 kilograms. Do you mean that, Pete? That's a lot. Now, type 2 is in remission. I'm jumping out of my skin. Good on you, Pete. If you lost 85 kilos,
that's fantastic.
That's some enormous weight loss. Peter from Windsor says, evening, Phil, ask your guests if there's any value in using those blood sugar testers at home, the ones you get from a chemist. Carolyn?
In pre-diabetes, I don't think so.
Right.
It's probably more a fact then of changing your lifestyle factors to try and minimise the effects or the progression to diabetes, and then getting the formal testing with your GP. But once you're diagnosed with diabetes, it can be useful to start monitoring, because then you get more information about whether the meal that you've had did contain enough or too much or too little carbohydrate, particularly when you're taking certain medications that can increase the risk of something we call hypoglycemia, and it's the sugar level dropping low.
Hmm. All right, that Pete from Dorrigo that I just sent us a text has actually given us a call as well. Pete? G'day, Pete.
How are we?
Not too bad. That's a fantastic effort at weight loss. How did you do it?
Mate, I'm absolutely bouncing out of my skin.
Yeah.
Where's
the rest of you, Peter? That'd be bouncing around somewhere too, would it?
Well, I actually did rescue for 28 years, and I got diagnosed with chronic post-traumatic stress, and I became a hermit.
Right.
And not sleeping at night and that. I had bad eating habits and all that sort of stuff, and I put on massive amount of weight, and I got up, I'm not kidding, I got up to 208 kilos.
Wow.
I am now back.
You were a big boy.
I'm now back down. I'm really proud of this. I am back down to 110 kilos.
Wow.
Well done.
And a big part of that is a big thank you to Professor Talbot in Sydney. Mm-hmm. He helped me out. Magnificent man. And
how did you do it, Pete? Just take us briefly through how you did it.
Well, first thing was I had to get my head around the fact that I was dying. I was dying.
Yeah.
I was killing myself. And I had to get rid of the word diet out of my head. I struggled with the word diet. Every time I thought of the word diet, it would trigger me off. So I changed that with the help of my psychologist to I had to adjust my nutrition intake.
Mm-hmm. A bit like Alan's saying. I mean, yep, don't think so much about types of food. Think of quantity.
Look at the positive of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that with I had a bit of a growth in my stomach as well, so I had an operation in Sydney. And they ended up doing a gastric sleeve on me,
mm-hmm.
and I've never seen it brighter. I used to have chronic pain in my legs with the cellulitis, and they'd be itchy and getting infected, and I don't have any of that now. I've got my little support pooch here, and her and I play with the tennis ball every day now. I can actually run around with her and not...
Yeah.
Just sit on the lounge. And it's phenomenal.
Yeah, well, that's a fantastic effort. Good on you, Pete.
And I'm in remission and I'm staying there.
Well done.
Good on you, Pete. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, that's that operation doesn't work for everybody, but I'm really glad it has for you. Alan, just before we take some more calls, one of the things that I found interesting while I was reading about this condition today was that people often say, oh, you know, don't drink sugary drinks. Sugar will, you know, give you diabetes. People associate sugar and diabetes, but it's not actually an automatic association, is it?
No, it's not.
What's the truth about sugar?
It has a very long... So we've known about diabetes for at least a couple of thousand years.
Hmm.
And over the centuries, we've swung from blaming sugar to thinking of it as the cure, believe it or not.
Really?
But mm-hmm. the modern association actually goes back to the 1920s and 30s when we first isolated insulin, and it was in dogs, of course.
Mm.
And we started doing experiments on dogs where we'd chop out a bit of their pancreas, and a North American professor discovered that the sugar glucose raised blood glucose levels quite rapidly, and starches, the other kind of carbohydrate, didn't. And that's the origin of the modern let's avoid sugar for diabetes story.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, as I've just alluded to, starches, of course, are the other kind of carbohydrate. So there's two main kinds of carbohydrate, sugars and starches. And simply focusing on sugars doesn't, of course, address the starch side of the equation. So just eliminating sugars from the diet won't automatically make your blood glucose levels better, because you have to be careful of the kinds and the amounts of starches that you eat.
When you say starches, an example of what are starches?
Yes, that's right. So people don't know what
sugar.
They are.
We understand sugar, I think.
We do. We understand sugar all too well. We're a bit obsessed with it at the moment. Starches, of course, are what's in your cereal grains.
Right.
So rice and wheat and corn, rye, barley,
bread.
Oats. So the things that we make out of it, so bread, breakfast cereals, but also things like legumes, so beans, lentils, and chickpeas, for example. So what I think a lot of people call them carbohydrates, but the carbohydrate in them is starch.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, sugary foods, it's the fruits that we consume, but also dairy foods. So milk and yogurt also contains sugars naturally as well. So these are all carbohydrates. And you know, the sugars that you're talking about, the sugar sweetened beverages, of course, can contribute to weight gain if we have too large quantities of them and too frequently. So that's where that association goes. But it's not actual causation. In fact, if we look at the large population studies, there are no associations between sugar consumption and risk of type 2 diabetes. It is only the sugar sweetened beverages that there is an association.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. So people shouldn't obsess about sugar particularly.
They shouldn't obsess. I think the World Health Organization guideline of 10% of energy is a good guideline. It makes a lot of sense for people to follow it, but we don't have to avoid every single grain of sugar. And in fact, some colleagues of mine at the University of Sydney looked at the most recent National Nutrition Survey, and if you go below 5%, which is the lower limit recommended by WHO, you actually start to increase the risk of micronutrient deficiency, so vitamins and minerals. So you can go too low. So we need to be sensible. You obviously don't want to have too much, but obsessive avoidance isn't necessary or beneficial.
Sophie says, in my humble opinion, you can improve your blood glucose levels by ignoring diabetes educators' advice of eating three meals plus snacks. I don't know whether that is your advice. This just makes us fatter and more diabetic.
Well, that goes back to what Alan was saying before. If we cut back out on the snacks, then you'll have less food intake and therefore hopefully less weight gain. The story with the snacks came about from people with diabetes, being diagnosed with diabetes on certain treatments, and particularly the earlier preparations that we had lasted a long time, stayed in the body a long time, and could cause the sugar to drop down too low unless you had these little snacks in between. So that's when that advice came in. But now we've got so much better treatments available that don't necessarily drop your sugars too low, so that the need for the snacks is not as important for most people, and therefore, yeah, it that advice is not a dog standard for everybody.
Okay, all right. We're talking with Carolyn Koronoff, who's a diabetes educator, and Dr. Alan Barclay, a dietitian, and we're talking about diabetes, and in particular type 2 diabetes. Love your thoughts on all this. If you're living with it, 1-300-800-222 is the number. Lines are free. Grab one. Text 0467-922-702. It's 23 to 11, 23 to 9 in Western Australia. Across the country, this is ABC Radio, and you're on Nightlife. Kathy's on the line. Hi, Kathy.
Oh, hello.
Yes, Kathy, hi.
I was going to the doctor for my 80th driver's licence renewal.
Your 80th?
Yes.
Good on you, yeah.
And I was sent for a whole lot of tests, and they said I was pre-diabetic. I said, but I don't eat sugar. And anyway, after a discussion, it was decided it was the brown rice flour that I was eating.
Okay.
I switched to barley flour, and my blood glucose level dropped considerably. Now I can eat anything, they tell me.
Good on you. They gave you your license too, I hope, Kathy.
Yes.
Good on you. Good on you. So, I mean, I suppose, Alan, that's the point you're making, is that we should address it whatever age we're at.
Well, there's that, and there's also the fact that it's not sugar alone that you should be worried about when it comes to diabetes.
Because I think there's a big association, isn't it, sugar and diabetes?
It goes back generations. I mean, my grandfather had type 2 diabetes, and I remember him avoiding sugar assiduously. And so it stuck in my mind. But it's not just sugary foods. All carbohydrates are actually broken down and turned into glucose in the bloodstream.
So we should think about eating less carbohydrates.
Well, not necessarily. Some people do eat too much, but Australians in general actually have a moderate carbohydrate diet. It's not particularly high, but of course there's always exceptions. That's the average. So ideally, like this lady's case here, we will go through what she's eating and drinking and then work out what's the issue with her. And she wasn't having lots of added sugar by the sound of it. It was this refined rice flour. And that's
perfectly understandable. As far as drinking is concerned, what are we worried about here? We're obviously, you know, sugary carbonated drinks are off the list.
That's right.
What else is off the list?
As far as beverages, well, you just need to be sensitive. Obviously, I think we all know that water's the best drink for quenching thirst, but of course we don't just drink when we're thirsty. We drink for social occasions, and I think that's then where we have to think about, well, what do we have instead? Despite popular misconceptions at the moment, the diet soft drinks are actually fine, and certainly people can have those. There are no high quality studies that suggest that they are an issue. They certainly don't put up blood glucose levels, and they will actually help you to lose weight if you use them instead.
So those diet soft drinks are okay?
They're okay.
Yeah. Carolyn, you were saying?
Well, I think alcohol is an important point to make here. You know, we are a drinking nation here in Australia, and I think that's probably where we go overboard a little bit. And alcohol does get converted to sugars in the body as well.
That's basically sugar, isn't it? I mean, alcohol gets broken down in the body and into sugar. No, Alan?
No, it doesn't.
Okay. What did you tell us what happens?
Well, alcohol is, of course, a poison if we have too large a quantity. So we have to break it down. Otherwise, you know, if you drink too much, you go unconscious and pop off.
Yep.
So what happens if you're eating other foods with it, which we usually do, and it's usually savory snack foods, because we're burning up the alcohol, we'll be converting those extra foods into fat or glucose. So it changes the hierarchy, I guess, of how we use energy. But alcohol itself isn't converted into glucose. And there's a bit of a myth
what does
around...
What's it get converted into?
You just break it down into its component molecules, and it gets oxidized like all other fuels, carbon dioxide.
Because I think a lot of people do think that, like Carolyn was suggesting that.
And a lot of people think that alcoholic beverages contain a lot of sugars, but they don't. I mean, there's a lot of beers out there, for example, saying low sugar, but people don't realize that most beers actually don't have a lot of sugar in them.
Well, I'm sure my cardiologist told me that the drinking half a bottle of wine, he said, is like eating four Big Macs.
Certainly quantity of kilojoules, I think, and this is the thing I've been lobbying for.
That's where I wanted to head towards.
Is 2,100 kilojoules in a bottle of wine, white wine, about 2,400 kilojoules in a bottle of red wine because of the alcohol. So we certainly need to be conscious of that, and it was going to contribute to weight gain, which in turn is going to raise your risk. So I think that's probably right. What Carolyn
that's
was on about.
Yep.
I think we don't put kilojoules on the bottles of our alcoholic beverages. So people don't know, you know, your analogy with the four Big Macs, there's some truth to that, and people just don't know because we don't label those beverages appropriately.
Okay, so it's not because the alcohol is converted to sugar. It's just that the alcohol has a high kilojoule value.
Correct.
And that at a high kilojoule value causes you to put on weight.
Again, the old beer belly that we used to talk about.
But it's not because of the sugar in the beer.
It's not the sugar, it's the alcohol. Okay. And I think that's the thing that we
now that's miss. Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, but then the weight gain, of course, will lead to the pre-diabetes and diabetes. Yeah. Yep.
What do we think of Michael Mosley's blood sugar diet? It's 800 calories a day for 6 weeks. Will this reduce your chances of becoming diabetic, says my texter. And a related text, I came in a bit late here, but is the intermittent fasting that Michael Mosley, that's the 5-2 diet, is that worthy of discussion in this current discussion about pre-diabetic conditions?
Yes, certainly the 800 calorie diet. Did you say calorie or?
Yes. This is Michael Mosley's blood sugar diet.
So that's what we call a very low calorie diet. And one of the easiest ways and probably the safest ways is to get something from your pharmacy, which is like a shake, or you can get soups and bars because they're nutritionally complete in theory. They contain the vitamins and minerals that we require for long-term use. You can do it with food. It's a little bit trickier. It's harder to get all of those vitamins, minerals, but certainly it is those kinds of diets that have been used in clinical trials, particularly the meal replacements, the shakes and things, that actually do put people into remission. So certainly that will work. It's a matter of finding out what's best. And, you know, ideally you're going to be seeing some health professionals that will keep an eye on your blood glucose and whether you're taking other medicines. If you're taking the tablets or insulin that we talked about, they will have to be reduced. If people have high blood pressure, that might have to be reduced as well. So it needs to be done. If you've got diabetes, it needs to be done under some sort of medical supervision with a healthcare team.
Okay, let's get into some more calls. Hello, Brian from Perth.
Yeah, good evening. I'm just curious your comments on comparing, you were talking before about carbohydrates and starch. I was 125 kilos, I'm now 90. I've not exercised in 12 months and I moved away from carbs to more of a high fat, low carb diet. And it's understanding what the carbs do to your body. But I was under the impression that for every 4 grams of carbohydrates, your body converts that to 1 teaspoon of sugar, roughly.
Alan?
Well, no, gram for gram, it goes into sugar. So for starch is just chains of sugar. So
a gram of starch is a gram of sugar?
Correct. Ultimately, it's broken down, it's digested and absorbed, and it's converted to the sugar, which is glucose. But that's not a bad thing. Glucose is an essential nutrient. Our brains and nervous system.
We have to have some.
We have to have some. I mean, babies have, you know, human breast milk has one of the highest lactose concentrations, which is a form of milk of all mammalian species. So it is an essential nutrient. There is a low-carb trend at the moment. It will work. The thing that you actually should be aware of is, in fact, for every gram of glucose in the body, when it's stored in the liver or muscles, it actually stores 3 to 4 grams of water. So a lot of the weight that you lose when you go on a low-carb diet isn't fat. It is, in fact, glycogen and water. That's why these appear to be better. But most people, I see people clinically, most people don't come to me and say, Alan, I want to lose some glycogen, please. They actually come to me and they say, I want to lose some fat. Mm. And so these low-carb diets don't necessarily make you lose more body fat. You lose more weight, but the weight that you're losing is water and glycogen. So you'd need to be aware of that. The other issue with these diets, there are some longer-term trials now. They often are better at 3 and 6 and maybe even 12 months, but come 2 years, very few people can stick with these diets, and they're going back to their ordinary, healthy, ordinary eating ways because they're quite socially disruptive.
Well, we've found a way of managing it, my wife and I. I said 12 to 2 years ago, I was 120 kilos. I was diagnosed as diabetic. My markers are now fine, and my cholesterol levels, my HDL and LDL are no problems at all. The diabetes is not there. I've lost weight. I haven't actually had to exercise. And it is a bit of a challenge to find the right things to eat, but it's understanding what foods you eat and how that changes in our body, reducing the blood sugar spikes and the depressions that come from blood sugar spikes, because that's when people start to feel hungry, and just trying to keep a constant level of blood sugar so you don't feel the need to snack very often and you're therefore not eating the additional crappy food that we eat.
You're absolutely on the right track, I think, yeah. By understanding your body better, by understanding what impact certain foods have on your body, you can make some changes, and I think that's a good thing you're onto.
I just feel that anything that gives me bacon and eggs for breakfast, it works for me. But, look, that high-carb, low-fat, low-carb, high-fat sort of movement, whether that's what I'm following, but I just cut the carbs out and try to stick to 20 to 30 grams of carbs a day. It's worked for me, and I know it's working for a lot of other people. Okay. So.
Thanks, Brian. Good on you, mate. Appreciate the call. You're screwing up your nose there at bacon and eggs for breakfast, Alan.
We've been there and done that. Unfortunately,
we know the bacon story, don't we? You probably should.
Exactly. I mean, this
bacon on your birthday, isn't it?
I mean, processed meats, which includes bacon.
What about eggs?
Are associated with risk of type 2 diabetes in itself, and we think it's the nitrates that are actually affecting the gut microbiome. Eggs, they're a source of cholesterol, providing your diet is healthy overall, then it's not necessarily an issue. And people with diabetes, of course, can have eggs like anybody else. But if you do have high cholesterol levels and you have a diet high in saturated fat, then that extra cholesterol will raise blood cholesterol levels even more.
Okay, but provided your cholesterol levels are okay, eggs are fine.
Then it's okay. And if your overall diet is healthy, if it's not too high in saturated fat, you're having plenty of mono and polyunsaturated fats, then it's not necessarily a problem either. So really what I'm talking about is patterns, and I think we have to be careful about that. The other point I would like to make is that there are many ways of eating well. I would include a low-carb diet as one possibility. If I would recommend any, it would be the CSIRO version, which is actually quite low in saturated fat and high in mono and polyunsaturated fat, and it's also high in dietary fiber. A lot of the low-carb diets aren't, and what we don't know is the long-term consequences of that, because if they are quite low in dietary fiber, the people might be at risk of getting colorectal cancer later down the track, because people with type 2 diabetes are much more likely to get colorectal cancer.
I don't want to confuse everyone, but we've done a few shows about diet, and I thought the current thinking was that butter and cheese, once reviled as the worst possible thing you could eat, were now generally okay.
Again, it's not about any food being good or bad. It's about the balance. So there's nothing wrong with having butter if you want to, but you need to make sure that you're balancing it out with other healthy fats as well. So, for example, having olive oil, fatty fish, nuts and seeds. So the rule of thumb is for every gram of saturated fat, you have 2 grams of mono or polyunsaturated fats. In other words, It's a 1-2 okay. ratio.
Right. To just put it simple, everything in moderation.
Kay from Greystone says, my darling Nan used to always say a little bit of everything and not too much of anything.
There you go.
How right she was. Let's get to some more calls. Sorry, Henry, you've been waiting on there.
Good evening. How are we all?
Oh, well, thanks.
That's a story. Many years ago, there was a promotion of apricot juice. I fell in it and I got diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
It was my favourite drink. And
How much were you drinking, Henry?
Oh, quite a considerable amount. I loved, right when I was a kid, I used to pick apricots and used to eat quite a lot. And then after the first day, I didn't eat any. But what bothers me today, I've been to a number of different dietitians, and these groups that I've been to, they don't seem to care much. What seems to be, they dish up a lot of stuff that you're not supposed to have, like sweet cakes and God knows what not. And I said to them, we shouldn't be having this, and they just poo-pooed the whole thing. And there's other people turning up with Big Macs and God knows what not, and it amazes me, and I can't work out. Well, at the moment, I haven't been able to do my walking around. I usually do 4 or 5 miles walking each day. And today, my cholesterol was up to 13.4, and I can't work out how. Of course, I walked probably about a mile, that's about all. But the last 2 months, I haven't been too good as far as walking and that, and it bothers me now that my cholesterol's up and down like a yo-yo.
Mm. Alan, any thoughts?
First of all, I thought I'd comment on the food that you're getting at your education sessions. That sounds a bit odd, and I think certainly Caroline might want to comment, but Diabetes Australia certainly had very strict policies about what foods and drinks could be provided at education sessions. So it does sound a bit strange. I certainly would be surprised to hear that if it was coming from that organisation. As far as cholesterol, if you've got a cholesterol of 13, that's very high.
Well, it certainly is.
There might be some sort of familial condition there. I don't know. Have you stopped taking medication for that?
No, I haven't stopped taking medication at all.
No, well, I certainly would be seeing my doctor ASAP. You need to get that down. Obviously, people with diabetes in general have a higher risk of heart attacks and strokes and other complications relating to blood vessels. So keeping your blood cholesterol under control is just as important as keeping your blood glucose control with respect to that.
I seen him a couple of days ago and he looked at my chart and, of course, it had been dropping quite reasonably well, but it just hit 13.4 today, and I just can't work out why it'd gone from this morning was 7. And it's up to 13.4.
You're talking about glucose.
Yeah, yeah.
You're not talking about cholesterol. You can't do a home test for cholesterol, as far as I'm aware.
Well, but it wouldn't change like that. No. It changes over about a 3-month period. Mm. So anyway, it's blood glucose.
Yeah, anyway, Henry, look, stay in consultation with your doctor. I think that's the important thing that we would probably offer here. Where we are, David from the Central Coast. Hi, David.
How you going, guys?
Not bad.
Just curious, I've got a couple of questions.
Yep.
First one is, I went to the doctors the other day. I was a smoker and I've quit lately, or in the last 12 months, right? And all of a sudden my weight's going up. And I went to the doctors last week and got just a finger prick test to see how what my blood levels were, or my glucose levels were in my blood.
Mm-hmm.
Is that an efficient enough way of testing whether you may have pre-diabetes, because I'm a bit confused, because as I said, since I quit smoking, I've started to put on weight. I've gone from 80 kilos, which I've been for about 10 or 12 years whilst I was smoking, and now I've quit smoking, my weight level's gone. I'm now at about 86, between 86 and 88 kilos. So I'm a bit confused, and also like, the doctor has noticed that I have put on weight around my belly. As you said, that middle part is where they mm-hmm. sort of look at for when you have a pre-diabetes. So just curious on
on one, the test that I did, the finger prick test, whether that's a reasonable, guide to show whether you do have...
Is it, Carolyn?
So the finger prick test is not considered a diagnostic test because there's too much variation between meters, although the meters now are, there's less variation, but there is still about a 10% error margin in most of these meters. So a formal pathology test, laboratory test, is still the golden standard. The other thing is, as we alluded earlier in the program, if a sort of a 10% weight reduction can convert back from pre-diabetes to no diabetes or from diabetes to pre-diabetes, similarly, putting weight on can increase your risk of developing diabetes. Certainly, it will fast-track things. So if there's any way that you can lose those 7-8 kilos again, I think that will help you enormously.
Yeah, I think the snacks are the thing I've got to stop having. I think it's boredom.
I don't think too many people, who've given up smoking, know where you've been.
So if you're bored, go for a walk.
Chew some chewing gum.
I've got work.
Go to bed.
I do that during the day anyway because I work nights. That's probably the other problem as well.
Yeah, on you, mate. Bye-bye. No, I only say that only half in jest, actually. Going to bed can sometimes be quite a good weight loss thing because you can't eat in bed. Well, not easily. We've talked about diet. Exercise is important to us. Now, is exercise important? Look, exercise is good for you generally.
It is.
But in this type 2 diabetes situation, is it because it helps you lose weight that it's important or just...
Many, many reasons. So the muscles are our metabolic engines and they'll soak up extra glucose from the blood even without insulin. And, of course, general fitness is good from cardiovascular health as well. Mm. And yes, it's going to burn up the calories. So there are many, many reasons to be active every day.
All right.
Certainly activity has been proven to reduce the insulin resistance we spoke about earlier. Mm. And that effect hangs around for quite a long time. So if you go for a walk now, you'll get benefits from it for the next 24 hours or so.
Mm. Yeah, it gets back to this thing that if you can, try and find something you can do, but if you can do it, anything you do is better than nothing.
Absolutely.
And if you can do it for 30 minutes a day, just find something that you can do.
Yeah.
And that might just be walking for 30 minutes, but if you can do it... And
whatever you enjoy.
And you can do it regularly, it has untold benefits over a reasonably midterm period.
Yeah.
Less sitting.
Less eating.
Less sitting.
Oh, less sitting.
Yes, the standing desk.
Absolutely. So if you can't, if you're at work, you're stuck in the office environment, you can't go for a walk, at least if you stand up a few more times during the day and do more standing time, that will help.
Okay, so just some takeaways from this. So don't get obsessed with sugar particularly because that's not really...
Only part of the story.
It's only part of the story. Be obsessed with the total quantity that you're eating.
Kilojoules count.
Okay. So we're trying to eat, on average, about a quarter less. Yep. If you've got a pre-diabetic situation, eat about a quarter less than you're eating.
Yep.
So that's simple. Don't worry so much about what you're eating, but about the quantity
The quality counts, of course. But, if you cut out the snacks, the discretionary foods, and stick to core foods, then you cut out that extra quarter and you're going to lose weight.
Low GI, is that important?
It is important, but calories trump it.
Okay, so if you're eating lots of low GI, that's no good either.
Exactly, that's right.
That's lots of porridge and things like that.
Yeah, porridge is fantastic. Low GI foods are important because they put less strain on the pancreas and you produce less insulin, but ultimately you need to lose weight and calories are the most important factor.
And exercise, as we know, is a miracle treatment, which produces also all kinds of benefits, makes you feel better too for a start.
Yeah. Absolutely. So and you eat less and move more.
And you can reverse a pre-diabetic condition.
You can. You can reverse pre-diabetes, you can reverse type 2 diabetes.
Yeah, interesting. All right, terrific to have your expertise. Dr. Alan Barclay, dietitian and research associate at the University of Sydney. Alan, great to have you in.
Thank you very much.
And Carolyn Koronoff, who's their diabetes educator as well. Carolyn, good to have your expertise as well. Thank you. Thanks to both of you, and thanks for the calls and texts as well, with a lot of people with success stories from following pretty much that advice, actually. For a condition that affects 2 million of us, it's important.